and welcome to Batflips and Nerds, the podcast that offers a British take on baseball. I'm John McGee, back from the land of opera and chocolate cake, and back in the world of hardball. Joining me this week to talk a big week and a half in baseball news is the man who kept my seat warm last week, Darius Austin. How are you, Darius?
I'm good. I hope you find the seat still warm, John, and didn't mind too much missing out for a week.
No, that was no problem at all. And I very much enjoyed listening to you and Ben talking about pitch framing, amongst other things, last week. I thought it was a really great chat. And thanks for keeping things ticking over whilst I had a lovely time at the opera in Austria, which I heard a lot more of than I saw. You guys who've listened since the start will probably have noticed that we had a different opening jingle this week. That was the brilliant and short-lived Newcastle band The Motorettes and their song I Am Blisters. And that's where we're going to start. We're going to start, Darius, with Blisters. I wanted to get your take on Rich Hill's seven-inning perfect game, a unique feat in the history of baseball. How did you feel about that when you read the news that the greatest pitcher in the history of baseball had managed to write another line in the record books?
It had to be Rich Hill, didn't it? I'm conflicted about it. There is sort of the sensible thing to do. The Dodgers have obviously got one foot in the postseason already, and with, you know, Kershaw's injury concerns and all the other injuries they've had, I can really see why Dave Roberts did not want to chance a player who'd had so much trouble. I think these blister issues have been going on for about 2 months now. And it certainly sounded like the opinion of the medical staff was that it was already, you know, they could tell it was getting worse again. And if they left him out there, then they could potentially be looking at him, you know, missing more starts. On the other hand, I think it might have crossed that line at some point. There's a line between what's sensible for the team and whether you're actually just stopping the game from being fun altogether. And I think for many of us, it felt like this might have been it. Certainly in the midst of a perfect game, they were up 5-0, so it wasn't a case that they were at risk of losing the game. If he'd give up a hit at the start of the next inning, they could have just pulled him and brought in the reliever and it would have been fine. So I think it did feel a little bit too much like, if this is the approach we're going to take, then are we just going to start to lose all of those really memorable moments in baseball, because nobody's going to get to complete perfect games unless they're at 60 pitches through six innings or something. And yeah, I think slightly too far maybe on the front of sucking the fun out of baseball. And I know that this is maybe the kind of thing that people level a criticism at Sabermetrics sometimes as well, that it's not really the spirit of the game, if you will. It's something that just takes all the heart out of it. And I think this decision did feel a bit like that. And I think Richard probably felt like that as well.
Yeah, he certainly did from the pictures of him muttering in the dugout that we've all seen. Yeah, I think it's kind of on that line, isn't it? I mean, we're sat here having a conversation on a podcast called Batflips and Nerds, which I think says that we try to skirt that line between making baseball fun and looking at the analytical side of things. But I think I'm just about with you in terms of, I do want to see something extraordinary when there's an opportunity to do so. And when I woke up to read what had happened, I was quite dispirited. As you said, particularly given the dramatis personae, it being Rich Hill, a man who all of us who listen to Effectively Wild, and certainly as a Red Sox fan, have gained a great deal of affection for his story over the course of the last 6 to 12 months. So, yeah, maybe he'll come to be glad about it in the course of time, being the only man who's ever done it. But that remains to be seen. And I do see Dave Roberts' point, but I was also quite surprised that he was the guy to do it. He's always seemed such a sort of fun guy, a likable chap as a coach and as a player. And I did wonder whether he was under orders. I wondered if, I mean, he said Hill didn't have a pitch count, but I wondered if that might have been the curse in the background there. I don't know if you thought that too.
Yeah, you do have to wonder how much involvement is there. The Dodgers have about six GMs in that front office now, so yeah, You've got to imagine there's a lot of influence coming from behind the scenes. They obviously pulled Ross Stripling in the midst of that no-hitter earlier this year as well. a game that was against my Giants, so I remember that well. But that was kind of a little bit more excusable in the sense that he was coming off Tommy John. I don't think he'd ever thrown 100 pitches in a game before, and he'd sort of started the inning and walked another batter, and he didn't really look like he had it anymore. Whereas that didn't seem to be the case here. So you have to imagine there's some kind of pressure on Roberts to maintain this team, especially with the Giants kind of not looking like they're really going to keep the pressure up. The division looks relatively safe for them now. And so I think I would be very surprised if there wasn't somebody, whether it's Andrew Friedman or somebody else in that front office, who'd kind of said, you know, we need to be as careful as possible with him. And certainly all the medical information that came out said that this decision was backed by somebody who looked at Hill's hand and said he's going to get another blister. And as we know from the previous couple of months, that could mean him missing several starts if it gets worse than they let it get. So, yeah, I'm sure there probably was some pressure there coming from someone in that front office.
So the question I was going to pose to you was if Dave Roberts was the reincarnation of Jeremy Bentham or John Stuart Mill in terms of utilitarian, trying to bring the greatest happiness to the greatest masses in the longer term. But perhaps it's Andrew Friedman or somebody else in that front office I should be asking the question about. This did seem a rather utilitarian move. Let's be down on fun and let's be up on winning. I guess that's what baseball is really all about in its sort of apotheosis, but it kind of isn't too, and that seemed a bit of a shame.
I'm sure the Dodgers fans won't mind too much if they do go on to win the World Series and Rich Hill plays a key part in that. But I think perhaps for us who are neutrals, or certainly not Dodgers fans in my perspective, it is the least interesting decision, and we aren't going to care as much if they win the World Series. So I think for the MLB audience as a whole, then it is not really the decision that brings the most joy to the most people. It's just purely for the Dodgers organization and perhaps their fan base.
So moving on from the actions and activities of perhaps one West Coast front office to the notorious activities of another, and moving down the coast from Los Angeles to San Diego, we find the curious case of AJ Preller, a man who was suspended for 30 days this week for withholding medical records in relation to a number of deals that took place around the deadline this year. The first one being the transfer of Colin Ray to the Miami Marlins in a 7-player deal that also involved Andrew Cashner and a bunch of interesting prospects. But the one that really came under scrutiny was the trade of Drew Pomeranz to the Boston Red Sox for their number one pitching prospect, Anderson Espinosa. That's the one that's caused all of the issue, seemingly. With Ray, the diagnosis was that he had elbow problems, and it looks very likely that he'll go on to have Tommy John surgery in the short to medium term. And actually, the noise coming out around Pomeranz, there was some tweets in Buster Olney yesterday saying that he too has elbow issues, and as a guy who's had elbow and shoulder issues in the past, that certainly seems potentially problematic for the Red Sox in the long term, and maybe a bit worse than some of the whispers that had been coming out in the first place. So the question that I had for you, Darius, was kind of in light of this and in light of what was an unprecedented but seemingly quite light penalty, where do we put the price on morality in baseball, certainly in terms of player transactions?
I think the most important thing here is obviously the player health, and that's maybe something that can get lost a little bit in all the discussion of suspensions and whether Preller is doing the right thing. It does seem like at least two players here have probably had treatment that wasn't optimal for them, or in some cases no treatment at all. The word on Ray, I think, was that the Marlins didn't even know he was taking anti-inflammatories until he came out of that first start. That really seems like something that they should have known about. And while I don't think that the Padres knew that he was going to need Tommy John, I'm sure that there was somebody there who thought there's something bigger underlying this inflammation that he's got. And they hid that from the Marlins in order to get him to agree to that trade. So I think the other problem for the Padres, and maybe we'll find out over the offseason how much of a problem this is that you've got to keep dealing with these people. Preller is going to have to continue to try and make trades with the GMs. And if they don't think that he's got any kind of morality or compulsion to actually tell the truth when making these deals, I've got to think that it's going to be more difficult for them to make trades. And presumably now teams are going to be questioning everybody they get offer, wondering what's wrong with the players, because clearly he doesn't have any issues with withholding information and trying to get a little bit more value than he might otherwise be able to get if people had the full details in front of them. So I certainly think probably everybody does this to an extent, and it seems like Preller has maybe gone that little bit too far, where certainly it sounds like Dave Dombrowski and the Red Sox have decided that this was worth reporting to MLB, that he crossed the line here. And it sounds like they had Dennis Lynn on the Ringer podcast earlier this week, and he was talking about how much pull Dombrowski has with the main organization, with Rob Manfred and MLB. So perhaps Preller has also just done this to the wrong team, who's got someone's ear. I'm not sure how you feel from a Red Sox fan perspective, but certainly it seems like Dombrowski had quite a lot of influence on this suspension.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it sounds like he did. I mean, from a Red Sox fan point of view, I was pretty taken aback, particularly given that this is the second major trade that the Red Sox organization's made with San Diego in the course of the last, less than 12 months with the Craig Kimbrel deal in the offseason. It seemed to be that they're establishing a good relationship, and clearly the Red Sox felt really aggrieved in order to sort of take that forward. I mean, you made an interesting point about what it's going to do to Preller's standing within the game, and the player that it immediately made me think of was Tyson Ross, who even coming off the back of a rough year with injuries, was probably going to be an interesting trade piece over the winter. And I wonder for him what the knock-on effect might be. I wonder if some teams who might have been looking at Ross as an interesting sort of number two, number three to boost their chances next year might just not go near him because he's in San Diego and he's coming off the back of an injury.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. I guess the good thing for the Padres is that it does only take one team. And, you know, if there is a GM or two out there who isn't really bothered by Preller's antics, or at least thinks that they can get the better of him, then it maybe won't matter too much. But I think it will probably certainly limit their market. And I would be surprised if there aren't some GMs out there just saying, I don't want to deal with this guy at all. So we'll have to wait and see on that front. And they certainly don't have a huge number of great trade pieces, so it might be quite a difficult off-season for them in terms of activity.
And on this, I just sort of wanted to look at things from a devil's advocate point of view. So, I mean, we've established that there's been some pretty shady skirting the line conduct going on here. But is there not a sort of a duty on the buyer to make sure that they do their physicals, they ask the pertinent questions? I mean, as someone who trained in a previous life as a lawyer, that's a big principle of contract law, buyer beware. So should that not be the case in baseball as well?
Yeah, I think from a legal perspective, Preller probably looks a lot better. From what I can gather, there isn't actually a rule that says you have to provide this certain information on a player. And in a court of law, you know, we've seen front offices and organizations in all of the American sports, I think, operate with fairly little regard for actual rules. Certainly Roger Goodell over in the NFL just seems to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. And I think this suspension is sort of a little bit of a weird token thing. I think perhaps if it had been more serious, the Padres might have contested it. And if nothing had been done, then obviously there would have been complaints from the Red Sox and the Marlins. But I think this might be kind of a little intermittent, don't do this again, but actually it doesn't really have any impact on the Padres as such. It's, you know, they've not really got a significant fine from what I can gather. And it's not a key time for the franchise in terms of making trades or signings. So I think it's kind of one of those situations where they're not really saying, you know, you've done something terrible here. It's kind of just a little a light warning. And I think maybe were it to get to a court of law, and I'm sure it won't, but Preller might have a pretty good case that in terms of the rules and regulations of the game, he hasn't done anything wrong.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think, sorry, my first reaction when you mentioned Roger Goodell was just that I was glad that that Tom's away this week and you didn't raise a red rag to a bull in front of a passionate New England Patriots fan. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I was gonna ask the question about whether the punishment did fit the crime, but I think you've maybe answered that question in terms of your take. I was quite surprised that they didn't get a draft pick taken away from them or some docking of their international signing bonus, which would have been a disaster for a man like Preller, who certainly loves his Cubans. We'll see, I guess. The other thing that sort of sprung to my mind, just sort of wrapping things up, was how could anyone rightly trust a man who looks so much like he was a minor member of the Rat Pack with all of their shady associates during the 1950s and 60s? He could definitely hung out with them. He could have been in Ocean's 11, certainly the original, if not the remake, with those piercing blue eyes and that lustrous hair.
You sensing a film coming up with this one?
I think so. Maybe what could it be? Ocean's 15? Or Ocean 7 it could be, couldn't it? Because they went from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, the Marlins and Padres trade. It would be a pretty rubbish denouement in which Colin Ray and Luis Castillo were sent back in the opposite direction.
Who would you pick to play AJ Preller in this adaptation?
Well, whenever I see AJ Preller, I always think he looks quite like Harry Connick Jr., who has some form in a few children's movies. So perhaps him, or maybe Joaquin Phoenix. He looks a bit like him as well, and he's also got some form playing slightly dubious characters. So yeah, I think I'd have Joaquin Phoenix as AJ Preller. What about you?
Yeah, that sounds like a good shout. I think you definitely need... He's got those sort of piercing eyes, hasn't he? They're very blue. He's got quite a striking look to him, and I think Phoenix is a good shout. So I can see that. I know he's a bit of a strange guy, isn't he, Phoenix? He really gets into his characters sometimes, so it'd be quite interesting. Maybe have him shadow Preller for a month. I'd like to watch that alone, I think.
I think that itself, I mean, working in the film industry as I do, I might actually try and pitch that to some of my colleagues, see if they go with it, given that Preller is notorious in terms of his hardcore lifestyle for never sleeping. I think even someone like Joaquin Phoenix might crumble under the pressure of being AJ Preller for a month. Right, I'm from one extreme GM or one extreme current GM to an extreme past GM. A man who's going to be back in the baseball hot seat, at least in the coming months. That's Ben Sherrington, who is joining the Toronto Blue Jays as Vice President of Baseball Operations, a role which is going to be focusing on player development. Of course, Sherrington left his role in Boston around June, July last year, following an absolutely rotten season in Beantown, the second in a row, that coming off the back of the 2013 World Series win. He took the rap for some pretty shocking signings over the course of the last offseason in Pablo Sandoval and Hanley Ramirez and Rick Porcello. And I would imagine he's probably sat somewhere in Toronto in a dive bar somewhere telling everyone who'll listen to him that they were wrong in Boston and he got it all right. Would you agree?
Well, two of those signings you just mentioned have actually been really good this year. Porcello has really been one of the better pitchers in the AL, and Hanley looks like he's back to his old form again. So the less said about Sandoval, the better. And I'm certainly, as a Giants fan, I think we dodged a bullet by not re-signing him there. But I think if Charrington is going around telling people that he got it right, then certainly he's not wrong on those details. And a lot of this team, obviously, whether they were drafted by him or just a part of a system that was predominantly overseen by him, were players who were Cherrington's players and not Dombrowski's. You know, he's the core of this team was really all there before he left. So I'm sure you have some thoughts as a Red Sox fan, but I think there are a lot of very good things about the Red Sox organization that were put in place by Cherrington, and certainly the comments coming out about people from this signing and people after he left the Red Sox suggested that he was a very good GM who really made a lot of difference to the organization and sort of really seemed to have a good command of multiple aspects of running a team.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think his hands were bound. There was that rule that there was a lot of noise made about that the Red Sox wouldn't sign a pitcher over 30 to a blockbuster deal, and that certainly manifested itself in not taking John Lester back, and who subsequently has gone to the Cubs and been absolutely outstanding, only for that rule to then be broken the following year with David Price coming in on his huge $217 million contract, and you know he's had his problems, but looks like David Price again. You kind of wonder if Cherrington rues that. But let's be honest, Price has been good for half of this year. Craig Kimbrell's been Craig Kimbrell, but again, you know what Boston had last year in terms of the pen wasn't really a problem. And Chris Young, the other big Dombrowski signing, hasn't. Much as I like him, I think he's a really good player, and he seems a really good dude. He's not winning the games this year. It's Bogarts, it's Betts, it's Hanley, it's Rick Porcello, it's Travis Shaw, Andrew Benintendi, Jackie Bradley. And if these guys weren't signed by Ben Cherrington, then they were signed by Theo Epstein and probably recommended by Ben Cherrington. So, yeah, I think the worms turned for his reputation in Boston. I think he now is getting a lot of credit. And I think people are genuinely pleased to see him back in the game, although not with a rival as big as Toronto are at the moment and are probably going to be at least for the next couple of years. The other thing with Cherrington, I have to say, given the tone of the discussion that we just had and everything that we've heard, I was really surprised that he's taken the role that he has. And I wonder if that was a personal decision that he didn't want to perhaps take the job at the Twins or something that would come up in the offseason. Did you kind of feel the same?
I thought his comments were very revealing. He made some references to the fact that before he felt like, you know, he had a goal, he wanted to be the GM. That was where he was going. And now he doesn't feel like he needs to do that anymore. And I wondered if sort of underlying that was maybe a sense that he doesn't really enjoy the acquisition on sort of the free agent contract side, perhaps unsurprising given some of the deals that didn't work out for him. But that player development is really his favourite thing. And now he was in a position where he could choose what he wanted to do. He obviously knows Mark Shapiro. He was a scout back in Cleveland when Shapiro was there. So I think maybe he's got a good relationship with him, and he thought it's an opportunity to work in an organisation I think is good, focusing on the thing that I enjoy the most. And he didn't feel the pressure that to go and get a GM job where he would maybe do some things that he doesn't like or he doesn't feel that he's as good at. And yeah, I just thought his comments there hinted that perhaps he didn't really have that same interest, even though by all accounts he was relatively good at being a GM. He actually prefers to focus on one specific aspect of the organisation.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Okay, and next we're going to... So that was the sort of news roundup. Oh, there was one last thing. There was one last thing I was going to mention. We actually recorded the next podcast yesterday evening, so we're doing this slightly out of sequence. More on that at the end of this one. But we in the course of that had a conversation about a pitcher I know that you're a big fan of, John Gray of the Colorado Rockies, and I just wanted to get your quick take on his pitching line from last night, which was the 17th of September game against the San Diego Padres, where he pitched 9 innings, 4 hits, no runs, 16 strikeouts, and got a game score of 102, which I understand is the third best of all time.
Yeah, just incredible. Some more stats on that. That's the best record, best number of strikeouts in franchise and stadium history. Nobody's ever struck out 16 in Coors before. So more incredible records there. I spoke to you beforehand how I was annoyed that I didn't pick him up in fantasy. I had a look at him a couple of leagues yesterday and I just couldn't do it because it was in Coors Field. But I think this just speaks to the level of talent that Gray's got. And if he can master this on a more consistent basis, I know this is the Padres, but when you strike 16 players out in a game, you're just good flat out. You can't be a bad pitcher and do that against any team. So I'm really excited about Gray going forward. And as you said, we'll talk more about yesterday's and the next episode later. But I certainly think that it might provide some hope for the Rockies going forward that they haven't had for a long time.
I think hope for the Rockies and hope for us all, because who doesn't want a hero in baseball who is obsessed with chasing ghosts and posts his own ghost chasing videos on Instagram? He is exactly the type of sports personality that we all want and we all deserve. More John Gray, please. And from John Gray's ghost chasing Yvette Fielding impressions onto something rather more sober and important. And that is Adam Jones's comments in the last week on the place of black players in baseball. So for those of you who haven't followed this, firstly, where have you been hiding? But secondly, in brief, Colin Kaepernick, the San Francisco 49ers quarterback, made a stand against the plight of black people in America and black sportsmen in specific by kneeling during the national anthem during a preseason game. He's continued to do so through the course of the start of the season. A few players have joined him in that defiant act and others indeed. In baseball, that hasn't quite manifested itself yet. And Adam Jones, the Baltimore Orioles center fielder, a very eloquent, intelligent, and thoughtful guy, as well as an excellent player and a real ambassador for his club, was the first person to stand up and make some comments. And for those of you who haven't read them, go away and find them. But in brief, there were a couple of things which stood out. The first, and I'm quoting here, was that he says that we, black players, already have two strikes against us, so you might as well not kick yourself out of the game. In football, you can't kick them out. You need those players. In baseball, they don't need us. And in summary, and in following that up, baseball is a white man's sport. Those were pretty incendiary remarks, Darius. And, you know, immediately I just thought, wow, that's a really brave and strident thing to say. And I just hope it doesn't have repercussions. I think the baseball commentary app was swift to sort of gather around Jones and sort of make a human shield for him. And I was really pleased to see that. I don't know about you. What was your initial reaction when you read that whether it was a brave thing to say or the right thing to say, or just glad that an eloquent guy was taking the stand like that?
I think all of those things, really. Jones is exactly the kind of player that we need to be speaking out, because he's got enough profile. You know, he's significant enough a player that I think people know who he is. People will listen to him. And certainly with everything going on around Kaepernick, it was kind of a thing that was a stark contrast. We've seen lots of players in the NFL come out in support of him, and I think it was something that needed to be said. You know, why wasn't this happening in baseball when there was so much going on in the NFL? And I think he's right. You just have to look at the makeup of the game to see that it's so different. They make up such a small percentage of the player pool relative to sports like American football or basketball,
and or football for that matter.
Yeah, or indeed football. Yeah, so I think it was something that needed to be said. There's obviously very heavily skews towards white men, both running and front offices and playing baseball. And I think unless people like Jones speak out about this kind of thing, then people don't really think that there's a problem there. And there's obviously myriad causes for that problem. But yeah, I think it was both the right thing and a very brave thing for Jones to come out and say so publicly.
Yeah, well, he hasn't been universally lauded for this. And one of the people who has been quite outspoken in his criticism of Jones was the general manager of the Arizona Diamondbacks, Tony La Russa, who made some rather strange comments in response when asked about Jones and doubled down on them a number of times in an interview that he did with local radio in Arizona. I think speaking specifically about Kaepernick rather than Jones, he said, you're not going to be out there representing our team and our organization by disrespecting the flag. No, sir, I would not allow it. Which I just think is a really odd comment. I mean, first thing I thought about that was that it's a very American comment, a very American thing that, you know, disrespecting the flag is seen as more incendiary than taking a stand for your own race or your own people or those who you feel that you're representing. I thought it was a very odd comment, really. But that wasn't the worst of it. La Russa himself, a white middle-aged man, a baseball Hall of Famer in his own right, and a very good player, of course, went on to defiantly disagree with Jones that baseball is not a white man's sport. He quoted some statistics that I needn't share with you now, but I think he kind of missed the point, and I think a few people have sort of pulled him up on that, and I think quite rightly so. I don't know if you had any thoughts on La Russa beyond those that have been made elsewhere, Darius.
Well, I mean, I probably have lots of thoughts on Tony La Russa. Most of the things about him in the last few years that have not been
relevant
good,
but, in this conversation.
certainly there have been some decisions from the Diamondbacks generally over the last few years that have not been impressive to the vast majority of people who follow baseball. But yeah, I certainly think he completely missed the point. And I think he really illustrated Jones's point very well, probably entirely unintentionally on his part, that this is the kind of guy that Jones was speaking about, who basically tells players, you know, to be in their place, that you don't get to say what you want. You know, you can't represent yourself. You have to toe the party line, as it were. You've got to be an organizational player first. And if you step out of line in any way, then that's unacceptable. And I think it speaks to this rather unhealthy attitude that many Patriots have in general, that you're not allowed to say anything critical, that somehow this is un-American. You know, it makes him a bad player for his organization and a bad Patriot, basically, that he would come out and highlight an issue within the sport by making these statements. And the same obviously goes for Kaepernick. The implication from La Russa as well, I thought, was that Kaepernick was doing it sort of on a publicity basis, almost, that I think he made some comments about he didn't see him doing it when he was starting for the 49ers. I think in a lot of ways that's irrelevant, really, whether or not, and I'd like to think that Kaepernick wasn't motivated by that in any way. But either way, I think it's raising a very real issue. And I think La Russa's comments suggest that almost it is a lot more important to people like him that you just have everybody in your organization and in your country step in line, which is a very dangerous thing to say, I think. And sort of his comments implied that, you know, we've done the best we can and this is fine. And I really don't think it's fine. And I think if Tony La Russa can look at the state of America and think that everything is just fine on a racial basis, then he's a deeply deluded person.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I think there's an absolutely outstanding article coruscating and virulent and really, really angry article written by Jeff Passan from Yahoo Sports, which I'd urge anyone listening who hasn't seen it to look up. But the line that really hit it home for me on bisecting La Russa was that he was, I quote, an authoritarian happy to share his opinion, but not respectful enough to allow others to use their platforms in the same fashion, which I think is exactly the point you've been making, that it's all very well being a patriot, but you should respect other people's point of view too, in terms of talking up passionately about what they believe in. Just on that point, were you not, I mean, I certainly was, I wonder if you were too, not a little bit disappointed that there wasn't more censure shown towards La Russa, either by the Diamondbacks people or by the MLB themselves? Or do you feel that this is just too big of an issue, too much of a hot potato for them to sort of pick up and try and, you know, make someone a scapegoat?
I think in a sense, this is two sides of the same coin. Tony La Russa is entitled to his opinion. I think his opinion is deeply flawed and people need to tell him that he's wrong. But I think if you don't have people airing that opinion, I think it's probably more dangerous for people to be, you know, sitting there at home holding the same kind of views as Tony La Russa and nobody to come out and challenge them. And I think Passan's piece is incredible. The lead is just one of the best things I've read in a long time, pointing out the hypocrisy and just the sheer ridiculousness of someone like La Russa making these comments. But I think, you know, this is about free speech, and Adam Jones is entitled to say what he thinks is true, and Tony La Russa is entitled to do the same. And I think if you don't have these discussions, then people just fall back into their own sort of safe little spaces, and they never think about these issues. And hopefully, even though Tony La Russa has said some very wrong things, I think people will think about this issue more clearly, and maybe it will highlight to a lot of people, both here within baseball and on a wider sense, that this is something that we need to talk about. And I'm hopeful that the backlash to La Russa's comments from people like Passan will make people aware that, you know, this is not okay. But I wouldn't recommend reading the Yahoo comment section if you are on that Passan article, because it won't fill you with an awful lot of hope.
No, I think I'm going to give that a pass. yeah, there were a couple of other interesting bits and pieces that I picked up off the back of this, and a couple of other people who've been asked for their opinion or who have volunteered it. And one article I thought was really excellent alongside the Jeff Passan one was one by Kemba Walker, who's actually a basketball player rather than a baseball player, who plays for the Charlotte Hornets, which was on the Derek Jeter endorsed Players Tribune. So obviously that's an overrated website. Before we even get into it, I jest, it's actually quite good. He plays his sport in Charlotte, in North Carolina, obviously, where there have been an awful lot of problems, less to do with race and more to do with sexuality and morality surrounding the use of bathrooms by transsexuals. And obviously the NBA has chosen to move the All-Star Game away from Charlotte next year. So Kemba Walker was talking in the context of that decision, but very much there were a couple of quotes particularly in that article that I thought resonated and really captured what it was that Adam Jones, Colin Kaepernick himself, people like LeBron James are all doing. And the first was, he said that our voices, meaning athletes, not just basketball players, our voices together can become a powerful force. And I sort of read that in the context of the fact that Jones has been a sort of lone outlying voice in the sport of baseball, whereas in basketball, I think Kemba Walker is one amongst a chorus, and that's a little bit of a disappointment, frankly, that there haven't been more players of all creeds and colours who've come out to support Adam Jones. Really, the only person we've heard from is Tony La Russa. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that yourself.
Yeah, I think the fact that we haven't seen more players come out and say things like Jones is just symptomatic of the problem within baseball, really. I think in the NBA, there are so many African-American players, and I think they do feel a bit more empowered with what you were saying from Walker, which was a great article, that they can make a difference. You know, they can unite together. And when people see all those players, you know, really significant public figures that they hold in high regard, come together and talk about an issue, this makes a really big difference. And I think, you know, part of what Adam Jones was saying was that we don't feel like we have this power in baseball. We're not the same significant number in this sport as there are in the NBA or the NFL. And we don't feel like we can speak out the same way because we fear there might be repercussions. And I'm hopeful that, you know, Jones, who is a very prominent player, will speaking out will make a big difference to that. But I think it's something that people feel uncomfortable. I think, you know, people turn to sport and you see a lot of people say, I don't want to see politics on the field. And I think it's a really important thing that you don't just get to decide, oh, these players are role models, but they're only sportsmen. You know, this is something that really impacts heavily on a lot of people, a lot of young people watching the game, and I don't think you get to say that these players are role models, but they have to be role models in exactly this specific way. And as soon as it veers into some politics that you don't want to think about when you're watching sport, they don't get to do it anymore. I think they have huge influence. And I think Walker's piece was really good in highlighting the fact that they can make a difference. And he's not, you know, like as you quoted from the article, he isn't just a basketball player. You know, he can also make a big difference in a much wider sense. And I think one of the real powers of sport is that it can do that. It's not just about what's happening on the field, but if they can make a difference to the African American and other minorities and in the US then and around the world, then that's a huge thing, and they should use that to do them. And I think the more uncomfortable they make people, then I think perhaps the better it is, because it means that the issue is out there and people aren't just getting to sit there comfortably, watch the game, switch it off and never think about it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that quote that you touched on in Kemba Walker's article, it just gets to the heart of it, that these guys aren't just athletes. I think one of my pet hates, I think particularly with American sport, I think it's less of an issue over here in the UK where with football being so dominant, is people saying that this is sport, it's not politics, which completely ignores the influence that these guys, these individuals can have on public discourse and on public life. And it also completely ignores the history of these sports too. And I think that's particularly the case in baseball, where the story of racial segregation is so prominent in the history of the sport. You know, with Jackie Robinson, with Branch Rickey, and with, you know, as a Red Sox fan, that the stain on the Red Sox that is the legacy of Ted Yorke. I find it rather shameful that only one player has felt he can stand and say something like this in a sport that has so much to celebrate, and indeed does celebrate in terms of what it did to break racial segregation, a sport in which some of the greatest stars of every generation since Jackie Robinson's generation have been African Americans. I think it's absolutely atrocious that the views that hold the sway are those of people like Tony La Russa. And I think that there was a great quote from Sharon Robinson, Jackie Robinson's daughter, who's always worth listening to on these matters. When asked about her reaction to what Adam Jones had said to Colin Kaepernick and to all and sundry, she declaimed that her father, Jackie Robinson, was the kind of person who would want to remind us that we still have a ways to go. I think that what's happened in the last week and a half speaks to the absolute truth in that fact. But off the back of that observation, Darius, I wondered if there was anything that you could think of quickly or had thought of yourself. What can MLB do? What can they do to try and bring equilibrium to get more African-American kids involved in the sport, to make it easier for African-Americans to work in front offices and so on? Is there anything that they can do that they aren't doing?
I think, yeah, certainly on the front office level, that there needs to be more of a push to hiring people of African American and other backgrounds. It really does seem like a very white man's game when you look at the makeup of the people who are running the game, and I don't think that is good when you compare it to a lot of the other sports. I think probably kids look at that and see that it's just a lot of white men running the game, and there's also a lot fewer role models in the way that, you know, something like the NBA, you can turn on and there are hundreds of African-American players in very prominent positions. You know, all of the most famous players in the game are really African-American. You know, you see people like LeBron James, who has a huge profile, and I think we need a lot more players like that. That really helps to bring people into the sport, and hopefully we'll get more Adam Joneses who can do that. I know that they're making some efforts to bring the game more into the inner cities, where a lot of the poorer populations live, to try and make the game a little bit more accessible. And I think that will help. But there was certainly the impression from La Russa's comments that people think that we are doing enough, and the statistics do not indicate that that's the same thing. Whether, you know, there is an element that they just don't find it as interesting a game, I'm sure that that is part of it. But I think the difference is so stark that you've got to believe that there are more players out there who could be into the game. And I think maybe they aren't getting the same opportunities that a lot of white sort of middle class American players would get growing up.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, what one of the other stories about baseball that you hear that I do wonder if it has a lot to do with this is how the amateur scouting works with young kids. How it's all based on lots of tryouts, lots of camps, ferrying kids all around the country, and maybe the ones who can afford that are those who have parents who are well off, the ones who can take them to the Cape Cod League and wherever it is and afford to support them, which is obviously not going to be the case if you're a kid from inner city Baltimore or New York or the south side of Chicago. So, I wonder if that's something that they can focus on. That was the thing that sprung to my mind.
Yeah, certainly on the topic of Jeff Passan, if you've read his excellent book, The Arm, there's so much in there about the perfect game organization and these players going to showcase after showcase all around the country. And there are a lot of young African-Americans in the country who just don't have that opportunity. They don't have somebody who can afford to drive them around to every imaginable showcase. And you do wonder, perhaps, if they did try and cut down on this culture of pitching all year and tried to handle young players a little bit more sensibly, that might actually create a few more opportunities for players to get seen who might not otherwise be seen, because this circuit would no longer be the main place to go and see the top talent.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I do kind of wonder if that's something that we might see off the back of books like Jeff Passan's and certainly a lot of articles that have looked into organizations like that. I'm just a little surprised that people haven't drawn that causal link between these two issues more swiftly. So there we go. I think that was a good conversation on that topic. And I'm sure it's one we'll revisit at some point in the future, because it's not something that's going to go away. And I think that's a good place to leave it. We've got a few parish notices, as always, before we go. Just firstly, to ask you if you have enjoyed the podcast, if you could go to iTunes and give us a review, give us a rating, that really helps the profile of the podcast. We've had a few reviews already, we've got a few ratings, and we're really thankful to those of you who've taken 5 minutes out of your day to do that. If you've got a friend who likes baseball, who's in the UK or not in the UK, tell them about us if you enjoy it. Tell them this is a good 45 minutes out of their week to spend listening to some guys talking about baseball. If you've got a friend in the UK who you think might like baseball, hasn't found a way into it, hopefully you might think that we're the way to do it. Please tell a friend. Tell them this week, actually, because we've got a pretty exciting podcast coming in the middle of the week as a bit of a preview for the GB baseball team's World Baseball Classic qualifier, which is starting this Thursday in Brooklyn. The team are taking on Israel. Darius and I, as we alluded to earlier in the podcast, did an interview yesterday night. So yesterday evening their time, with the Great Britain. Well, I was going to say third baseman. He was at pains to point out he can play anywhere on the field, although he's largely playing as a third baseman at the moment. Jordan Serena. Jordan is in the Los Angeles Angels organization with their Class A affiliate, Burlington Bees. It was a really great conversation. He's a really lovely dude. He's the type of person who will make you want to root for him. So, that's a fun listen. It was certainly a fun conversation. I think you enjoyed it too, Darius, yeah?
Yeah, it was great. Jordan was really forthcoming. He had a lot of interesting info. We learned a lot about his, his college career and the minor leagues, as well as his involvement with Team GB. So I think it's really interesting, even if you're not, planning to be a GB fan, then I certainly think there's a lot of great information there. And if you are supporting them in the World Baseball Classic later this week, then I would definitely watch out for that one, because it's really interesting to talk to Jordan and hear his perspective on how he got involved with the team and what he's looking forward to.
And not to spoil the interview at all, but Jordan's story about how he got involved with Team GB is quite eye-opening, and I think certainly leaves the door ajar for all of us. So a little bit of hope for all of us following the way that Jordan got involved in the World Baseball Classic next week. And that's something to look forward to listening to for you guys. And before we go, just a reminder of where you can find us on the internet. The blog is at www.batflipsandnerds.wordpress.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at www.twitter.com/batflips_nerds. That's at batflips_nerds. You can find Darius on Twitter. Whereabouts can we find you?
I'm at DariusA64 on Twitter.
And you can find me at Epuvontail. That's the French word for scarecrow if you want to look it up. And we're on Facebook too. Facebook group is www.facebook.com/batflipsandnerds. And if you want to send us an email, please do. We always like getting emails and we don't get many. It's batflipsnerds@gmail.com. So once again, thanks very much for listening. Hope you pick up that conversation with Jordan Serena later in the week and get behind the GB boys in Brooklyn next week. That's all we've got time for. See you next time.